Okay, welcome to episode 33 of the Never Mind Anything podcast. This podcast is an occasional chat with a buddy about a comics creator or series that we are fans of. We will dissect and reflect and occasionally chuckle. I imagine there's going to be a few of those in this episode. My name is Tony Esmond, writer of the just released Tony Osmond is a Movie Star, no fucking connection between us at all, and editor of The Horizon Cafe by Emanuela Malari. In your shops now, go and buy it. Emanuela's a great talent and it's well worth your attention. Today we have a new guest but an old buddy. The Don of the Pickled Egg. The master of kitchen utility techno.
I've got one in now.
There you have. Not in your mouth, Lauren. And he draws a mean comics page. Yes, it's only flaming Dave Kennedy. Hello, Dave.
Hello there.
Yeah.
Hello, Tony.
I'm very fond of your kitchen utility techno from the other day.
Oh, jeez. Well, you know, when the mood takes you, you can't deny the beat, can you?
I messaged Dan and Vince and said, I can't stop watching him wig out. It's making my afternoon.
What was fun was in the other room, my wife was desperately trying to calm down my baby son because he was having a tantrum. So I was really needed elsewhere, but couldn't help myself.
Tell me, you just did one take. There wasn't two takes.
It was. Yeah. You don't get more than one take when it's descaling itself. Your coffee machine. you just got to leave the program to run. See what happens.
You're richer than Rockefeller. You can just buy a new one. Just get out there with all your movie maker money.
Rich, yeah. I still can't afford my perm. still saving up. About half of my back done. I'm waiting for this to afford the rest.
I had my back waxed once. And I don't know why ladies complain about it. Me. It didn't hurt, but it was very shiny. I felt like I could sort of slide down a concrete roof or something on it. It was sort of shiny and hard.
I've never had the wax. I've done a trim a few times. It does break your arms trying to get it done. But a mate of mine, when he had the snip, was telling me how incredible his gentleman's bag felt he said it was like a chicken skin or something. At that point, I terminated the friendship.
Yeah, don't speak to him, especially if he shows you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's enough. Yeah.
I had to make it clear on a very important American podcast a couple of nights ago that I hadn't seen my mate's willy. I felt that I needed to say it. But
is that like the old girl's dog in EastEnders?
Yes, a little bit. Yeah.
How long did that joke run for? Yeah. My God,
where's those my classic jokes of the 70s and 80s ran for years, though, didn't they? Let's face it. Otherwise, mind your language, you would have made no money whatsoever.
Yeah. They're still going in Wigan. Them jokes. Good God.
I know where you live. You ordered a comic. I've got your address. I know it's Wigan. Okay, so that's the longest preamble we've ever had before describing what we're talking about. But it's welcome.
They're bad sauce.
Mr. K, what are we talking about today?
Today I have opted to talk about Alien, the illustrated story by Archie Goodwin, and it would be Walt Simonson on the art.
Nice. Yes. So we're gonna try and pin down what we think this isn't just any old movie adaptation, aren't we?
Yeah. I've made a few notes, you know, as most of your guests have on this, and it needs to be said early on, I am not an expert in any way on comics. I enjoy them.
You are, dude, because you draw them for a living. So I think that kind of makes you an expert, you know.
True, but at the base of my skull somewhere, you know, I don't know whether it's the Catholic upbringing. I feel like I'm sort of robbing a living.
You, me and Brother Lawrence, we all understand it. Don't worry. Right, so let's dive in. So I wanted to know, how and where and why did this come into your life, Dave?
Okay, well, just to give you a very brief history of comics popping into my life, there was the one main source for them, basically. It was my dad.
Right,
he's from and worked in Liverpool when I was growing up here in Wigan. And he only recently told me about why he was getting so many comics and bringing them home and handing them over. And it turns out that the supply of comics early on, it's probably the same countrywide, I'm guessing, but I didn't know this, but comics and records and, like, you know, singles, 12 inches and stuff, rock and roll stuff, things like that, were used as ballast in the ships coming to the dock. And so Liverpool was absolutely crammed with comics, and half of them had no connection to any other comic that was out. It was like some obscure one-off issue where you would never find the issue before it or after it and so on. Obviously, things have developed now and you're able to do that. But because of that, my dad would turn up with random comics. And it went from, you know, the UK stuff, the Beano, Dandy, Core, Wizard and Chips. And as you mentioned the other day with Dave, Giles was one.
Oh, okay. He'd
bring a Giles book home.
I'm slightly obsessed with Giles, the sort of They're actually really beautiful things when you look at them.
Exceptionally detailed.
Yeah, yeah.
And to think that, like, it was always that old woman, wasn't it, with like a heavy set glasses or something.
She's become quite attractive to me in my older age. I think that might be the reason. Yeah.
Well, with books like that, there was also like, my dad was, when I look back now, I've been putting it together, this sort of like little list of things that he was getting, and some of the stuff he was grabbing was phenomenal at the time, because there was no way that was in our corner shop. You know, he must have gone somewhere and found it somewhere. So we had like the Bruins and Woolley.
Yeah. The Scottish comics.
Peanuts
was
another one.
Yeah.
You know, and then he moved on to like things that he'd probably find a bit close to home. It's like Starblazer, Star-Lord, 2000 AD, and stuff like that.
Robertson made me order a lot. He's forced me into ordering a load of Starblazer. I ordered them yesterday. He keeps messaging me to ask if they've arrived.
you want to knit yourself a suit out of them when they do, and then just like send in that picture. Leave the bottom half off, of course.
Of course. Yeah.
so he'd bring these things and he'd hand them over, and you know, that my introduction to comics was literally just coveting and sort of sitting with one comic for a long period of time and just enjoying that comic. And because I was at that age, you know, whatever I was, 6, 7 or something like that, I'm not going out to the shops myself to go and find comics. I'm getting whatever my dad's bringing me.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know where to begin to look for other things. I was just enjoying single comics as they were arriving. And there was Marvel in there, and there was DC and whatever else and so on. So that's me rough comic history there, out of the way.
Yeah. So what about this actual one then? So, which would have been slightly different, I imagine, because this is one of these graphic novels, I suppose we call them now, don't we? Yeah.
Yeah, but it stemmed, getting hold of this did stem from that history of my dad bringing me comics. You know, I didn't know if he had a plan. He was just dropping them off and I was enjoying them. So he must have seen I was enjoying them. Anyway, so Alien pops along, the movie, and it's getting talked about at school. And Lee Clark down the road went to Australia to visit his cousin and he'd seen it.
Clarky.
Scrubber he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he tells everyone in the street that it's dead Gorians, it pops out of a fella, and you never see it till right at the end.
Yeah.
And you know when you get these stories at school and it's all you've heard of that particular thing? Because in them days, if you're going to watch a movie, excited for a movie, the most you would see of anything would be a little natty black and white photocopied picture in Radio Times.
Some really shit copy, yeah. I remember I was at boarding school during the video nasty, when you didn't actually have to show any ID when you got a video. So we used to still stroll into town as 12, 13 and 14 year olds. The glory days. And we used to get like Cannibal Ferox and take it back and watch it. And then we'd be at lunch with all the day boys and, you know, in the week, and we'd say, no, yeah, and then they made him eat his own knob. And they're going, what are you talking about? Yeah,
I also feel like you could just say anything. Sean Ginnelly at school said that they turned Princess Leia inside out, and everyone was like, "What? Jesus Christ!" In a kids' film. So, like the playground was a real place to sort of fire up the imagination in a way. And Alien was being chatted about by a lot of people. And I still do this now, where a movie or a book or something comes along, and the idea of it is probably more exciting than the thing you end up seeing or reading.
Yeah, sometimes a documentary about it is more interesting, isn't it?
Yes, an example, great example was Blair Witch Project. A mate of mine gave it me on tape and didn't tell me what it was, and he gave me a rough description. He said it's footage of like these people who find a witch. I'm like, oh, fuck, what? So I started watching it and I thought, oh, it's in this style. It's probably real, this. And I had to stop it a couple of times because what I was imagining was worse than what the film was.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with Alien. I was 10, I believe, at the time when Alien was like being talked about, because it was out in 79 or something, but it was going to be on TV. I researched this bit, so I'd be proud of me.
Yeah, I think this is maybe when I saw it, actually. Yeah.
On TV?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like, basically, it was 1983, 9th of July was the first terrestrial showing of Alien on ITV, and I was 10, right?
Right.
And my dad must have heard my conversations with my brother and so on, that I was fascinated by it, but I was also terrified by the idea of it, and I needed that sort of like, I needed to see the monster. You know, it's being brought up on Harryhausen and seeing everything super clear and watching it walk around and being fascinated by it.
Yeah,
I needed to see this monster, and I had no idea what it looked like, but it meant watching a horror film, you know. And I'd probably seen one or two by then, you know, but this one was like getting really rave reviews of like, this gonna knock the shit out of you. So I stayed up one night, and it was that night, and my uncle was there, and he said, "Oh, this is on now, or better get home. I'm not leaving the wife to watch this on her own." And so the hype was building even more, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I bottled it. I got to the point where we knew it was going to burst out his belly, and I just said, "I'm going to bed." And I didn't know, remember really until recently that my dad had stayed up with me to watch it to make sure, you know, I was okay. He never mentioned that. He never sort of like
right.
said,
"Right, okay, I get
protect you,
you
son."
Yeah,
but he stayed with me to watch it to check that I was all right watching it. So
yeah.
I go to bed and I leave it. And anyway, a couple of days later, Dad comes back from work. Bang, and what's on the table? Oh, it's Alien the Illustrated Story.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so,
right.
And so he's gone out and found this. Now, it actually came out, I believe it came out 79.
Right.
The same year as the movie.
Yeah, I mean, there were, they pushed to get it out, didn't they? There was a big push on to get it out.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it in a minute, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but this is like 83, so this is like 4 years later. And he must have just gone and found it somewhere, or I don't know what he did. He may have gone looking for comics specifically. You know, he never really told me. But so he comes back with this and drops it on the dining room table and says, thought you could give that a go. And I'm like, I just threw my tea away. Just started whizzing through it because I've got to see this monster. And I finally see the alien in this book. So first of all, straight away it's cemented as like, oh, this is my favorite book now. You know, I'm going to read the hell out of this. But it was like, it also, I started looking at it as a method of taking in another medium, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah.
It's sort of like, because there was things around it at the time that was just building up this hype, like a Three of a Kind with Lenny Henry and Tracy Ullman, and the other fella, whoever he was, would do a sketch about it.
Yeah.
There was a model shop in the middle of Wigan Market where it had a picture of the alien in this side window, and I was dragged past it by my mum, and I couldn't fully make it out, so it was this massive mystery for me as a kid. What did this alien look like?
Right.
And this compulsion to see it was pushing me towards the film that I didn't feel like I needed to see at the time. So I got the story, read the story, really enjoyed it, and then something clicked with it, and the fear that I had about watching the film got replaced by being excited, you know, sort of
right.
like
okay.
really enjoying this type of thing. And I realised that the comic had done that, not the story itself.
It's weird, isn't it? I don't know if you remember this from when you were a kid, but we used to get a delay. So movies were never simultaneously released. And we would always be months behind the American release.
Yeah.
So subsequently, we used to get a lot of comic adaptions of movies before we saw them. And also novelizations. I mean, I remember reading, I don't know, Dragon Slayer and Clash of the Titans and all these sort of books.
All the Alan Dean Foster ones.
Yes, because he wrote Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which we spoke about the other night.
That's true.
And he did a load of that stuff. And even Star Trek, the motion picture, I think I read before I saw. And we used to get comics like that as well. So I remember reading, I don't know, Superman 3 before I saw the movie.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it sort of cements itself that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, the big one for us, I mean, listening to the one with Dave the other day was great because I'm big on Star Wars as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
like, as we all were at that age, because we were all hit it at the right time, really.
Yeah.
And again, gathering around Stephen McCarthy in the playground because he'd read Return of the Jedi.
Yes.
And, you know, it's unthinkable now to release a film, have something revealed in that film, and then wonder whether it's true or not for the next 3 years.
Because they told us they were brother and sister in the book.
Yeah, well, basically, that was in the novel, but we never had it confirmed that Vader was his dad.
Right, okay, yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, so the first question, like, Steve McCarthy rocks up and says, "I've read Return of the Jedi." He said, "Jesus Christ, is Vader really his dad?" And that was what everyone was asking.
Right.
And I thought, that's unheard of now, going 3 years without knowing a single thing about...
Yeah, I know, everything gets revealed in the trailer now, doesn't it? Yeah,
and that's sort of like that. Glorious fun of like wondering what's going to happen next. And you guys touched on it the other day with talking about Star Wars comics filling that gap and going off into different things, and whether they're canon or not, it doesn't matter if they're good stories.
Well, that's important for this conversation, I think, because there is a different element to reading. It's a different medium, and there's different things, not just in story but in visuals in this comic, and we'll talk about
absolutely
it.
Let's run through the
credits for it. So Alien the Illustrated Story is the official title of it. It's written by Archie Goodwin, art by Walt Simonson, coloring by, now I'm not sure who colored what, because I understand this got recolored
I'm
at
not
some
sure
point didn't
either,
it
yeah
my
yeah, I'm
the,
not sure.
I've got the Titan books one. I didn't come to it till about 10 years ago, this book. So yeah, I've got the Titans one. And the colourers are Walt Simonson, Louise Simonson, Deborah Pedler, Polly Law, and Bob LaRose. So there's quite a few in there.
A lot of colourists going on there.
Yeah, I don't know who was. One was maybe the original one. Lettering and design by John Workman. Now, as I understand it, John Workman and Archie and Walt are long time collaborators. So John is probably most famous for lettering his stuff. He's got a really distinctive style. If you read stuff like Ragnarok, you'll recognise the style immediately as being.
Yeah,
they're together. They're always.
Yeah, they're collaborators, aren't they? Yeah. I did discover that. I was reading about them. Yeah.
It was edited by Charles Lippincott. It appeared in Heavy Metal initially, didn't it? It was its original place. Now, I was trying to figure this out, but I think what actually happened was, because it said, oh, it was in Heavy Metal first. I thought, really? That's a bit of a weird one. But it turns out it was released in almost two 8-page teasers in Heavy Metal.
Was it? I didn't know that, right.
So in two issues of Heavy Metal, they actually had teasers about it, and then it became the trade, what we call the trade now. It was also the first book, the first comic, I suppose. They're all comics, aren't they?
Yeah.
The first comic to be on the New York Times bestseller list. And this was before they had a separate list of comics as well. So it made it onto there. And it stayed there for 8 weeks, from July to September 1979.
Yeah. None of that stuff. I didn't know any of that stuff until recently. I didn't know how revered it was.
Yeah, me neither,
Review-wise, you know. I just thought it was the book that I loved when I was growing up. So it was a personal thing for me. It wasn't about I got that book because it's popular. You know, Watchmen because everyone's telling me to get it.
Yeah.
I was quite pleased with that, finding out that it was really well received.
Yeah, a lot of artists especially. A lot of comic artists will tell you. Now, there's a number of versions of it. So, like, we've had the teaser version. We've had the early trade, which is the one with Alien written sort of almost two-thirds of the page with the little tendrils.
Yeah, that's the one I've got. Yeah. Got, yeah.
There's the new Titan version, which has got an alien on the cover, obviously. And there's also a miniature version that appeared in the 35th anniversary Blu-ray. So they miniaturised it. And also there's the... artist is kind of an artist edition.
Big artist edition, yeah. I've been eyeing that. I've been looking at that on YouTube. Jesus, that looks nice. Yeah. Purely because it's the colourless version.
Yep, so it's just the line work.
God, it's nice looking. It's really, really nice looking. I'm very close to pulling the trigger on that £55 comic.
Is that what it is? That's not bad for an artist edition, though, is it?
I think it's pretty good for that. Yeah, I mean, that's what this one obscure site says it's going to cost, but eBay's doing it for about 100 and odd at the minute, I think.
Right.
Even more. But good Lord, it looks nice. Yeah, it's purely because all the elements that I find so nice about the art are enhanced by being in black and white, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, I was going to say, I do like the colours, and the colours played a big part in it being a book that I went back to again and again. But it's only after getting them glimpses of the just the inked version where I think, you know, I'd really like to see that version. And it's highlighted just how like bright some of the colours are and how almost experimental it is in places, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'd like, just for the purpose of this conversation we're having, if we play the sort of 7 degrees of separation, we'll talk about this in a bit. You're currently working with John Carpenter. Now, didn't a couple of the writers work with Carpenter on Darkstar prior to this? Is that right? Did O'Bannon or someone like that work on it?
O'Bannon did work on it, actually. Yeah, that's very true. Yes, I think that is the case. I've just put my comic down on the other side of the room. One sec.
Okay.
Got it.
Good man.
Bannon is mentioned in the credits.
Right. Okay.
First page there.
Yeah, it's just interesting. I found the. I was just intrigued by the fact that I'm chatting to you. You're working with Mr. and Mrs. Carpenter, and then there is a sort of connection to Darkstar, which I kind of like. I like Darkstar. It's no Aliens.
You like Darkstar?
Yeah,
it's a cracker, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, I don't think there's any point in revealing the plot of this. Because I think if you haven't seen Alien, you should probably go and watch it anyway. But if you haven't seen Alien, I'd be surprised if you're listening to this podcast. There is a direct line of sight between Alien the movie and the Alien comics. There's so many Alien comics to shake a stick at. Yeah. But there's a couple of differences. I was going to go through them with you, and then we're going to sort of maybe chat a bit about Walt as well. The significant difference in this for me is there's a few, but the main one for me is the size of the Alien. The Alien is... bigger, taller, and slightly more broad than the one, the sort of there's a sinewy ballet to the. I've met the guy who played. He was in the suit of this Alien movie. He came into a comic shop I was in once. Yeah, and he's quite right. a slight guy. Do you remember Do you remember? I think it's one of the Superman movies where there's someone roller skating down the street as destruction around. That's that guy. That's the same guy.
Is it three? Yeah, I think that's three.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's the same guy, and he played this. And this alien is a lot bigger, a lot more powerful looking. He's more of a sort of truck size thing, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes. And there's also, if you look at, I think I was going to get onto this with still banging on about my story and my introduction to it, but one of the aspects I wanted to bring up was, bear in mind, this is my first introduction to the story. And so it inevitably taints this story that I see cinematically. Now, they both stand on their own, as far as I'm concerned. They're both pretty much perfect in what they're set out to do. And I can appreciate both of them. But like you say, some of the differences that stand out make the comic version the comic version and make it a thing that the cinema could never have done.
Yeah,
and one of the the one page I went back to again and again as a kid was the big reveal where we see it attacking Brett, the guy in the cap, Harry Dean Stanton, I think.
Yeah,
and now in the movie we don't see much; we see its mouth, but this is the big reveal in the comic, and it's huge. It is; it's absolutely gigantic, and it's muscular as well.
Yeah,
it's not screen accurate, really. They've taken the design elements that make it what it is, but it's got Simonson all over it. It's like the little sort of black lines and the deep blacks in the rib cage and stuff like that.
There's a touch of the feathering about what he does as well. There's that sort of broad brush down.
It's probably one of the only artists where you can literally see what he's drawn. I mean, you can see how his hands move to do it.
Right.
Because that sort of, I say it's one of the only artists. Obviously, it's bullshit. But it's one of the ones I enjoy the most. There's nobody does debris and smoke and rocket burns and stuff like that like he does, because you can see what the pen's done. You can imagine how his hands done it. And part of me still tries to do that.
I mean, that's the marvellous thing about comics to me, is you can have people with incredibly strong styles that anywhere else may overpower what you're seeing. But people like him and, I'm going to say Chaykin, they can still they still draw you into the story, but you can still see the real style, the real workmanship that goes into it. But the bit of the Harry Dean Stanton bit as well is the stabbing in the back with the tail. Does that happen in the movie? I can't remember. It's been a while.
It's hinted at, because you sort of see, this is a point I wanted to get onto a bit later on.
Okay.
Going back to the size of the creature and the differences in the movie and stuff, Simonson's playing to his strengths here. And what he's doing is I always remember, what's his name, Ryan Ottley, talking about, this is his opinion, but he says, if you're drawing comics, why wouldn't you exaggerate everything?
Yeah, that's the
because
point,
you can,
yeah.
Because you can. Now, that's great for his comic, and that's what Simonson's done here. When the chest burster comes out, Brett's getting attacked, in every case, the creature looks ferocious. It looks really fast, or it looks really big, and he's doing it because that scene needs it. He's doing it because we need to feel the fear of what that guy's seeing.
Yeah,
and
the chest burst is a really good example of that, man, because it's done on a page turn, isn't it? Which works perfectly. How else are you going to do that? But it also it bursts out and it takes up. It's kind of runs across two pages and it takes up almost a page and a half, and it's like fire and brimstone. And in the movie, it was insane, what's that fucking weird thing?
It just splops out, doesn't it?
This is an explosion,
Yeah, it's like he's given birth to a puppy on the film or something. But in this, bang, it's and the other aspect, the other part that the comics, take liberty with is almost like a narration. Now, it's not all the way through,
right? Okay.
But we've got Archie Goodwin's got on the chest burster scene, he's got this little box panel up at the top. The eruption, a scarlet shower of flesh of blood. And then we get a shot where it's multiple shots of the alien's face moving at speed across the page. Yeah. And he's saying it moves, and then faster than the eye can follow, and more than the mind can accept. And we show a shot of all the other staff, crew members.
That first bit you read out there, Dave,
Yeah.
Oh, I've spotted it.
The eruption.
This is part of my problem with this, actually, is the colouring of this book.
The
eruption.
It's lost, isn't it?
What's that all about?
It's done in the same colour as the back, as the actual art, and I didn't see that for about like 3 years after I started reading it.
Yeah, it's not. It's not where your eye moves, is it? Either.
No, no.
Okay.
But this is another example of this is what you can do in comics. Now he's basically we're left with the shock and the awe of seeing the same situation that the crew do in the movie, but in this adaptation, we've got him saying it moves faster than the eye can follow, more than the mind can accept, and. That line sticks with me when I watch the film.
Wow. Okay. I get you.
And it's the same with the more prominent one for me is the same with the attack on Brett, where he faces off against the creature. He's seen it and he's screaming. He's like freaked out as much as we are by seeing this big thing like looming over him. And we get this little panel. Brett tries desperately to scream. The sound is not in him. And then we get these. Few panels and they're quite cinematic. A few of them are very sort of like the widescreen format in a way, which is something as a kid I hadn't really seen or taken note of in the comics I was reading. You know, there was nothing like this in Peanuts and Wizard and Chips and Giles. You know what I mean?
I mean, there was nothing in sort of Western comics as widescreen as this was there. You know, and they take advantage of it in this book.
It's reminding you that it's a movie,
and
it's and I think we chatted about this on the Awesome Comics podcast at one point about the crossover of like how movies can feed into comics and comics can feed into movies, and this particular double page thing is a great example of it because there's stuff going on there that feels cinematic but simply can't be done in a film. How do you overlap an
very
image
true.
Successfully without it looking like a 70s music video? You know,
yeah.
If you're doing it like in a moving image, so whereas on the movie we get like a little shot of we see the tail sort of like creeping between his legs, and then we it's hinted at that he's pulled towards the creature and he's killed.
That's right, I remember now.
And we get this. I don't know if there's a name for this. You may know this, but you know you see those panels where the tail is popping up behind Brett, sticks in his back, pulls him towards him. Is there a name for how that those panels run because they're basically the same shot?
They are, aren't
that's
they?
Four,
yeah, but pushed,
four panels, all from the same point of view.
And he's pushed through to the left, isn't he, on those panels? It's interesting.
Yeah. Now, I think that is attempting to look and feel cinematic.
Yeah,
that's a way of saying here's your establishing shot. Here's where we're seeing it from, and because he goes off to the left, we know he's being dragged towards the creature. You know, and I'll get onto this a bit later on. But things that I have inadvertently borrowed from book. That I do every day in my working life. But this is one of them.
I mean, one of the other big differences, man, is the lighting. So whenever I think of the first Alien movie, I think of dark corridors and in the dark and in the shadows and you can't really see what's going on. But because this is a comic, it's much brighter. You see everything, you know. I mean, squinting to see what was going on in the movie on the shitty little television I had when I was a kid watching this compared to seeing it like this. I think I'd love to have seen it like this first. And you're right, it would have cemented it in my mind a lot more, I think.
It did do that. I still think they're interchangeable. I can still appreciate the movie as it is, and I can still appreciate the comic as it is. But there are certain things in this comic that I think have been achieved that you couldn't do in a film. And I keep going back to that. But
I agree, man, completely.
Brett tries desperately to scream. The sound is not in him is a little text panel there. And then Paige moves on where the tail drags him towards the open mouth and it says, and in the depths of his fear-choked throat, we get this big scream across the page and a massive blood splat. And you get the little phrase, Brett finds the scream. Now, that's very sort of like Stephen King-esque, that, isn't it? That's very sort of
pretty
like...
pretty poetic, man, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it's playing towards horror fans, but a 10-year-old kid... like hearing that, that's like, oh, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard. And because, going back again to what I was going to say before about, I've got it here, there you go, come, I've written it down, sorry. The thing about, illustrates it, I've got to write it down, so I'm going to say it. The illustrated story eased me into the world of horror by presenting it in a format that I associated with adventure in a safe environment that I was in control of. So
yeah, that's comics, true. You can look up and you're not involved in the comic anymore, aren't you?
And you can take it at your own speed. A mate of mine was like when he was first raising his boy and he was very young. He said he tried reading comics to him of a night, and he said you can't do it because the kid is either ahead of you or behind you.
Right. Okay.
Comics you take at your own pace, really, and that's what made me get through it. That's what made me get past the fear of, I need to see that creature, I need to see Alien, but I'm terrified.
Which is why it changes when you reach a guided view world. You know, people will be reading this in guided view, and you'll be swiping or pressing a button to get the next image,
Absolutely,
Should we talk a little bit about how this came to be, this? So, Walt was flown to the UK to see an early cut. And it was him who requested that Archie Goodwin be involved. Initially, it was considered that Carmine Infantino would be penciling it and Walt would be inking it, but that apparently fell out of bed. Didn't happen. Yeah. So he's flown over, and he was also given a number of slides. That's back in the day of slides, so pre-internet kids. He had slides which he could, you know, look at. And that's how he managed, because he said he'd done a movie adaptation before that. I'm trying to remember what it is. Oh, he'd done Close Encounters.
Yes, he did.
And he complained about how he couldn't quite get Richard Dreyfuss's face and that sort of thing because he didn't have any photo reference from the movie. So he said there was none of that with this because he... there's a really good interview on Comic Book Resources, I found, where they talk about it when they re-release the Titan issue. But yeah, so he went over and that's why it's successful. Now, there's the one big thing that everyone sort of argues about is the box scene that appears in this.
The box alien.
Yeah, the box alien. So there's a sequence in this graphic novel where who comes across it? Is it Ripley? I can't remember now.
It's Ripley. Towards
Ripley
the end.
Comes across what looks like a box, and it unfolds, and it's the alien. And it's creepy AF, I think, is what the kids say. But it's not. And he swears he saw it in a rough cut of the movie, but it's never been available anywhere. And you know, Aliens are the movies that. I suspect there's a lot of extras you can find somewhere or other.
Yeah.
And it's never been... And a couple of people deny it's been filmed until someone sort of said it had been filmed, but they're not sure if they were saying that because they'd read it in the comic and all this sort of thing. It's a really funny one. It's a great sequence. If it was in the movie, it would be very memorable, I think.
Yeah, it's an odd one, isn't it? It's like it adds to that, to the mystique of the alien, really. And as you probably know, I mean... Just going off how long the comics have been around, you know, Aliens is never going out of fashion. So
not, is it? Really,
it's,
isn't.
It's, it's probably got as many fans as.
Well, I don't know. Marvel
Star
got
Wars
it now. They'll probably drive it into the ground. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you'll have one riding Tony Stark down New York or something, won't you? Now, so
it'll be it'll have spider powers by the end of the week. It'll be fine.
You'll have a hood, big long hood.
It'll be in a Marvel team up. It'll be Predator, Alien, and Safe Space. They'll be all teaming up together. It'll be fine. And there's also a screenplay comic. So of they took the original screenplay. I think this is only a couple of years ago. Yeah. I think for the 40-year anniversary or something, and they made a comic of it. And I think Walt's done the cover for it. But that's something I haven't read. Right. I'll be interested in reading that.
That wasn't Alien 3, was it?
No, they made a screenplay of Alien the movie.
Alien. They did that as well. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think they've done that as well, which is the wooden spaceship thing or whatever it was, isn't it?
That is Alien 3. That the screenplay for Alien 3 was basically it was set on a wooden planet. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think they've done it for the first one because I watched the documentary on the making of Alien today, and I think all the different layers and sort of generations of writers who came up with it all fell out with each other, didn't they? They all argue about, you know, he reckons he got credit on it, he shouldn't have had a credit, that was all mine. There was all that sort of going on in the anniversary.
But the thing is, I don't care because I've got my comic, so I'm all right.
Good old Walt. He even got told about script changes, so they were quite in contact with him. He and Archie Goodwin came out with a comic, and I'd say very successful. I'm guessing this was your first exposure to Walt, was it, Walt Simonson?
I was going to ask you about that because I'm just researching him now. Walt Simonson's obviously in and out of pretty much everyone's collection. But did we get in the UK? I distinctly remember as a kid, I'm running through this list of comics I remember getting as a kid, and one of them was a run of Incredible Hulk. Now, I had the impression that I thought it was reprinted in the UK because the quality of the paper was really cheap.
Was he in Rampaging Hulk? I haven't made a note of this and I can't remember it.
This is what I thought it might be because just looking at... Walt Simonson's Wikipedia information and going back of that particular era.
Yeah, we did get... there was sort of vague distribution of the Rampaging Hulk magazine. I've got a few issues. So you might have seen it from I've got a few issues from back then,
I remember of it really was there was a cover where Hulk's punching a crocodile or something, and it was just that excitement of like he gets to fight a crocodile.
It was more sort of painterly covers of it, wasn't it? It was
and it was I believe it was sort of like more linked to what was going on in the TV show.
Yeah.
As in like that sort of setup really, as instead of a whatever Hulk story had been going on at the time for Marvel.
I think you're right, man. I think that did appear.
It was running with the idea that he goes from town to town and he's helping people and punching crocodiles when he needs to.
He did come back about 10 years ago and do the Indestructible Hulk as well, which was outstanding. One of my favourite things. I think it might have been Bendis who wrote it. But it's like amazing, like really good.
Yeah.
We'll talk a bit about, his history. So, Walker Simonson, born 1946 in Knoxville, Tennessee. Famously one of the nicest blokes in comics. I met him at New York a couple of years ago and had a picture with him, and he was the nicest possible dude. And I remember standing there and he was sort of scratching his head, and I noticed across the hallway was about 25 Beta Ray Bill cosplayers or something. I went to speak to him, but yeah, he was polite. Initially studied geology. He was really into dinosaurs, and I think he draws quite a few, and he draws them very well. And he says that, and he gives
you can see that in his creature stuff.
Yeah,
can't you
really can. Yeah,
you can absolutely see it. Yeah,
Sites influences of Kirby, Ditko, Toppy, Gil Kane. You can see the Gil Kane immediately, can't you? Friends with Howard Chaykin, even before they were signed. He studied art. Eventually, studied art as a major at the Rhode Island School of Design. Graduated in 1972, and used his Star Slammers for the first version of Star Slammers as part of his final thesis. He went to have a portfolio review at, I think it was DC, and in the room next door were a load of other artists, and he bumped into Chaykin, Michael Kaluta, Bernie Wrightson, and Alan Weiss. And they'd all turned up, it was DC, to have their portfolios looked at. And he said they all got on straight away. They were all friends straight away. His first work was in DC's Weird War Tales, issue 2, January 1973, cover dated. And then, I don't know if you've ever read Manhunter by him. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't actually.
Outstanding, man. When you think this is one of his first bits of work, and it was, I think it was a backup story in Detective, I think. But it's really, really interesting work. And it's then you start seeing that sort of the circular sound effects and the power punch and all that sort of thing. Really nice.
Yeah, because it wasn't, looking back at his very early work, it's not like evident there, really, is it? The shapes are there in you know, physical forms and stuff, but when he starts to find physical forms in stuff that doesn't have a physical form, you start to see like for example, him just doing the clouds of dust as the Nostromo's landing on the planet and stuff.
Yeah, I get you.
It's got physical weight, and it's just a line. And I know that any artist is you know, worth their salt can do that type of thing, but he's adding something to it, and it's almost psychedelic.
Yeah, there is, and there's something in the air, isn't there? There's effects and lines around people's heads and there's motion. Not in a manga way, in a strong sort of heavy line way often,
Absolutely, yeah, and it's something I can't like overstate enough how much of an influence these guys' work in this book have had on how I think a comic looks.
Nice.
Do you know what I mean? It's simply because the comics I'd had before that, they felt like they were sort of cartoons, you know, the Bash Street Kids doing this and Peanuts and stuff like that. Even to an extent, you know, some aspects of like Star-Lord and 2000 AD, which the guy who I work with, Mike Sizemore, Vortex, the writer, 2000 AD is his big love.
Okay, yeah.
And despite being introduced to it as a kid, I think I sort of spun off in other directions, and it didn't become like one of those things that I followed throughout my life in a way. So I'm aware of like very early issues, and I did get quite a few of them at the time, but for Mike, it really clicked with him.
Oh, nice.
Of like that anarchic thing. He's got a Steve Dillon dread tattooed on his forearm.
I think you told me that before. Yeah. I remember you saying,
it's a big thing for him, 2000 AD. And he's very sort of like, he does bring that element to the work, which is something that
I mean, there's a straight line somewhere in the world that compares someone's looking at a Walt Simonson page and saying they look a bit like Mike McMahon work. There's something of them somewhere in my eye.
There's a natural chaos, I think. Simonson's work on this is Simonson is it's messy, but it makes sense. And it gives
he works a lot on close up on faces, which I really like. You get a lot of emotion, a lot of shock, a lot of.
That was one thing I was going to bring up actually in terms of just his work really, which is likenesses.
Right, they're really good in this. Yeah, I really like them in this.
In terms of likenesses, I think the likeness thing is one of the biggest pitfalls of a movie adaptation. Even on what I think Dan posted the other week about finding the 1989 Batman. Batman adaptation, which I've got, and I read that to death as well because that was another one I was keen on at the time. But even going back looking at that, the artist is like really going for it in terms of trying to get really accurate likenesses on the characters. And I've got one somewhere of the Phantom Menace. Oh my sweet Christ.
Yeah.
There's a shot in it where Ben Kenobi's head is about three times the size it needs to be because the guy's been concentrating so much on getting the likeness right, he's forgotten he's sat next to a couple of people and you're going, oh my God,
fit them in now.
Looks like a Junji Ito comic, his head's blown up. And I think I wouldn't say I struggle with likenesses. I tend to go down the old route of, well, if I give him a beard, then people will know that that's him.
Right,
Even though he's got the same face as the other guy who hasn't got a beard. And Alien's great for that. Even the movie's great for that because the costume design for individuals and the way everyone's dressed, especially it's highlighted in this comic because everyone's got a colour code to how they're dressed.
Right, okay.
You can identify them straight away. But at the same time, he's doing likenesses that they do look like people, but they look like they're done very minimal, very quick. And he's got to the absolute core of what makes Dallas look like Dallas and what makes Ripley look like Ripley.
So you've got to remember, this is just post-Star Wars, isn't it? And everyone was screaming for a sci-fi movie. And everyone was looking for something. But I'm so glad they kept... I mean, they describe it in the documentary and the movie quite a lot. They describe it as truckers in space. And you get that out of the comic as well. And I kind of like that. The sort of baseball cap,
very much,
dirty... You know, horrible. Yeah. You know,
you get it in the backgrounds too. You get it in the mechanized sort of backgrounds and the stuff that's behind them. It looks knackered.
Yeah,
it looks like it's all knackered, doesn't
it? Let's just go through a couple more things for Walt before we move on. So, his other work, people might know him by Battlestar Galactica. He did with Roger McKenzie. Probably one of my favorite ones he did was the Teen Titans X-Men crossover. He did with Claremont. Yeah. He worked on Thor before, but it was 337, which marked the start of the run that he's probably famous for, where he turned Thor into a frog and we get Beta Ray Bill and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He continued on with that. A lot of people don't realise this, but he continued on writing it when he stopped doing the art. And Sal Buscema was drawing it, who spoke very highly of him, actually. He drew around this time, he also drew a Daredevil for Frank Miller, which is still not published. I'm not sure if he just partially drew it.
Yeah, I read that.
I'd quite like to see that.
That sounds ace. Yeah, that sounds great.
1983, during the initial run of the Marvel graphic novel series, they had like stuff like New Mutants and the Death of Captain Marvel and stuff. He did his Star Slammers. There was a Star Slammers that came out of that. Star Slammers was sort of a sort of vague constant through his life. He appeared quite a few times right at the start with this, and then later on it was in the... There was an imprint from Malibu, if you remember Malibu, called Bravura, and he had it in that.
Yeah.
I think they did a Dreadstar as well off Jim Starlin. Now, he was friends with he had something called Upstart Associates, which he and some friends formed in 1976. And they had a studio on West 29th Street in New York, and it was Howard Chaykin, Val Mayerick, take a drink because Val Mayerick gets mentioned a lot on this show, and Jim Starlin. And imagine the four talents in that room, how well that was going.
I bought
a Val Mayerick sketch the other day off eBay, and I'm sure it's fucking faked, but I don't care. I've got a Val Mayerick now. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those sort of things. he started writing the Fantastic Four, and he wrote the Fantastic Four when they became... Do you remember when they were Wolverine, Spider-Man, Ghost Rider, and Hulk for a while? He drew RoboCop versus Terminator, which I've never read, but I've looked at it in the shop and looks amazing.
I've got that. Yeah, I got the original run of that actually. That's nice. Yeah.
And then 2000, he started on Orion from the New Gods, which I understand it has just been traded. I think it's just in a hardback of that, which is also another lovely series.
Yeah.
He's done some Elric, which he wrote with he drew for Moorcock himself actually, and then we got stuff like Hawkgirl, Batlash, and stuff like that. And then I said the Indestructible Hulk, which I absolutely loved. And from 2019 onwards, he's been doing... Well, I think it's 2018 onwards. He's been doing Ragnarok, which I bought. I have the first trade, and I bought the second trade this weekend to read. And that's a return to just that. I mean, he's been doing it for ages, but it's so beautiful. It's so well drawn. It's incredible stuff. Have you read that, dude? Have you?
It is. I haven't. It's one of the ones on the Let's Get It list. It's and it's because of that image, the big snake, god, demon thing on that front cover. I didn't know. You know, I don't, like I say, I'm not a big one for actually following regularly what's coming out.
Yeah.
But that popped up somewhere on my feed, and I thought, geez, that looks a bit like... Oh, it is. And it was those shapes in like the, you know, the snakes sort of skin and the rocks around, the ground and stuff. And I just thought, I know that
he's
material.
So good,
isn't
he?
He just
is really good.
Yeah.
Archie Goodwin, we covered a couple of issues ago, Archie Goodwin, but famously the nicest guy in comics, and also the dude who was kind of the controlling hand between Epic for many years, and I'm a big fan of Epic.
Yeah.
He also wrote some Secret Agent X9 for Al Williamson, which is another callback to a previous episode, which is just amazing. And him and Simonson had worked on Manhunter before, which I think is where they got on so well, they decided to keep working on it.
They worked a lot together, didn't
they? Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
with Archie, but Archie Goodwin also created Luke Cage. I didn't realize that. But and there's also in Gotham, there's a Goodwin Airport, apparently, because he was so
right.
Yeah, cool. So back to Aliens, the Illustrated story.
I've
got the new one, which is the. I mean, it's gonna be, isn't it? Titan are trying to sell an Aliens comic, so they're going to put the alien on the front. But there's something sort of hauntingly, weirdly. Remember when sci-fi was dangerous? Remember when it was scary?
Yeah.
And I kind of like that original cover a bit more. I know it's not specifically part of the story. You know, the tendrils don't really come down out of space and grab the spaceship. But something about it had that strange quality to them. And I find it a much more iconic cover, you know?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I'm the same. Mainly because that image of the alien on the newer one is taken directly from inside the book, I think. And the big thing for me was seeing this on the table when my dad dropped it on the table, and I'm going to see what the creature looks like.
Yeah,
I finally get to see it now. Everybody's got a bloody alien bobblehead in the car now. There's no mystery there, but I can't tell you how much I needed to see that creature when I was a kid, because being brought up on Harryhausen and everything else, you get to see the thing that it's built up to be. By the movie,
it's
or by
so
the book.
Believable in this movie, and I have to say, I mean, they're two different movies, aren't they? The first one is a horror movie, and the second one is an action movie, and I love them both for different reasons. To be fair, I wouldn't choose between them, but funny enough, Walt also says in that interview that he's only ever seen the first two. He says, "I quite like Lance Henriksen. I might see another one he's in," and so I think the interviewer says, "Don't bother," but. I remember seeing the second movie at the cinema, and they're just in by the nuclear reactors, and one of them pulls a shotgun out because they're running out of guns. So they said, "Don't fire, that is nuclear reactors here." And suddenly the lights all came on, and they started selling ice creams. And they had an interval in the cinema, and I'm like, me and my mates were like a bit drunk, you know, going, "What the fuck?" That's like the most tense I've ever been in my life in the cinema, and you just asked me if I want an ice cream.
This has got nothing to do with it, but a mate of mine took his girlfriend to watch American Werewolf in Paris.
Oh God, I remember that.
And it's frigging awful. But they went to see it, and he's got a thing about werewolves, doesn't like werewolves, and they're watching it, and she's giggling away, going, "It's good, this, isn't it?" And he's going, "Don't like this, you know." Anyway, they're on their own in the cinema. And it was like an independent small cinema like you'd get, you know, like a cheap one. Independent cinemas now have a certain air of importance about them now.
Yeah, they're all very art house, and they've got couches on and stuff. And
But back then you'd have a cinema where it was next to a carpet shop, and all the ads before it would be for the local Indian restaurant or something. And this guy and his girlfriend are watching the film, and the guy who's selling tickets puts a werewolf mask on, crawls down the corridor, down the aisle, to about two seats in front of him, all the way along the seats, and jumps up. And he just pegged it. He just left the cinema, left his girlfriend laughing her head off. She ended up watching the rest of the film with the fella from the cinema.
My local cinema used to be the one at the Elephant and Castle, which was fucking, that was a shithole. If there wasn't a fight during the movie, you know what I mean? I remember some bloke along the little alleyway, you know, where you sit, the row from me, he dropped his weed, or dropped his, like, his resin. And he said he went and got the woman with the torch who shows you to your seats, and and she helped him find it.
Yeah. Oh, Christ.
That's a class cinema, isn't it? Yeah.
Jesus.
It's long gone now. Yeah, but there you go.
Yeah, God love them.
So good. So we're reaching the last stages. So is there any other bits of the book you wanted to talk about, Dave? I've got a few last questions for you, but I thought we'd maybe focus in on a couple. We focus in on a few there. I have to say one of my favourites is the big reveal of the spaceship. So you get they're out in the spacesuits early on. They're crunching their way across this heat. You know, the sun's just come up because we told you you got light in 10 minutes, Dallas, and they suddenly they're upon the. I find the colouring a little bit obtrusive somehow. I don't know why.
It's odd, isn't it? Yeah. It's odd, but at the same time, it's an overwhelming page,
it really
isn't
is, it? Yeah. And I think you're right, man. I'd like to see that in black and white. I think that would probably impress me slightly more.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, there's looking at the YouTube video of somebody reviewing that black and white version, there's also extras in the back of the book where they must have started working on sort of like concept pages without ever having seen the movie. So there's a page where you see an alien attack two people who look nothing like the people in the film on a ship that looks nothing like this, and it's a big like load of green tentacles with a funny face in the middle of them. But it's still like, you know, Simonson doing what he does. So you can see elements of that that attack with on Lambert and Parker, like where he's hitting it with the fire extinguisher and stuff like that. They must have been told about that scene and he's gone away and sort of done a concept page for it. And that one's really gaudily coloured as well.
Right.
So I'm wondering whether like they've... Whoever's seen it and said like heavy metal have said like let's have that, okay, we'll go for that once we've got all the slides and you can get on with it, but we like that coloring, you know, we like the big green tentacles and stuff, because it is, when you see the black and white version, you realize just how gaudy some of it is. You know, bright orange sky on that space,
it's a little bit a little bit bright for my taste. I don't think you get it, like I'm more of a lover of the Bronze Age of coloring. I think stuff is too blended and too colored these days, and it sort of makes it look a bit animationy, and I'm not that fond of it, but it looks to be colored by someone a little bit who's colorblind at moments.
Definitely someone who hasn't seen the film.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, but there's something about the colours as well. I did look at just like a couple of page shots and scans of the version you've got. And I think somebody's had a go at sort of doing a bit of a remaster on it and like brightened it.
Yeah, that may be the case, actually. I did wonder about that. Yeah, God bless Titan. They don't always pay complete attention to what they're doing.
Yeah,
as we've heard.
There is something like mildly faded and nicely nasty about this version that I've got, which, I mean, I had this comic from when my dad dropped it on the table years ago, and then a few years after that, a kid moved into a house up the street from me and started going to my school. Now, I realised he had no mates whatsoever, so I thought, I'll go knock and see if he's into the same stuff and whatever. And he was very quiet, but I lent him my copy of it, and he moved again within another couple of weeks. And I thought, I'll never get that back. So I'd been after it, like another version of it for ages, and it was only like, I don't know, 10 years back or something like that. I'm having tea at my dad's, and he walks in and drops it on the table again.
Your dad sounds great. So, bloody hell.
He's freaking brilliant, and I must have told him like about that lad dropping it. Anyway, he kept his eye out all those years and found it again, the same one.
Oh, nice.
And it was better because all the pages were still in it. All my pages had fallen out. I'd read it so much when I was young.
If he's listening, he might be listening. Of the 13 listeners we have on this show, you never know, one of them might be that man. Bring it back. Give it back to us, you thief. Yeah.
Yeah, you rat.
any other pages you quite want to talk about, dude? It really impressed you.
I don't know. I mean, like, sort of like, it's everything really. I think the things that work really well for me are when they're both working together, like the writer and the artist, and they're doing stuff that the film isn't doing. Like I say, I keep coming back to this stuff where, like, the countdown to the ship, where we're following Ripley around and we're sort of getting her thoughts, and it's that bit where she finds the box alien in the corridor. That's a great page, that, because you get this creepy box alien. She's running towards it. She's skidded in her tracks because she's seen it, not knowing what it is. And you see it slowly unfold over three panels, and then it's sort of on its knees ready to go. And she's running away, and we get the text saying, flight, away now from the access corridor to the shuttle. Back into the Nostromo, and this is one of my favourite bits, where you get like a, once again, a sort of cinematically paced three-panel run where you see the corner of like some machinery in the corridor, and then you see a shadow sort of come around the corner in the second.
What you're talking about,
And then the third panel, you get the mouth of the alien coming around, and the text giving us back into the Nostromo, not daring to look at what might follow.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of like you're playing straight to the kid who's reading all the Stephen King books there, or, you know, any horror book that had a creature on the front with like a black colouring behind it, you know, Sean Hudson.
Oh, slugs and all this sort of thing. Yeah, I know what you mean.
James Herbert yeah. and everything. It's pure fun horror.
That. Every page 70 in a James Herbert book has got porn. We found that out as teenagers. Yeah, the spear, the rats, all of these things. Yeah,
the dark. Yeah. All right. Well,
open on page 70 if you buy a second-hand copy. But the other thing I wanted to mention is the lettering. So the lettering by Workman is superb in this and really readable and clear.
Lovely,
apart from the bits where the colouring obscures it. But the I don't know if you noticed in your version, but if it's language that is mechanically filtered. So if it's from an intercom or from a space suit or over a walkie-talkie or something, it's done in blue, and the rest of it's done in black, which I thought was clever. And I think it's
that's a great point, and that brings me on to something I wanted to say about the stuff I have unknowingly lifted from this book for my entire life. The use of panels, for example, the widescreen panels and those succession panels where you get the same shot but something is happening and developing within that same panel, just like that alien face coming around the corner I just mentioned. That's one thing that I didn't realize until quite recently that this book has instilled in me that I like to do in comics. So for example, Mike might send me a script where we need to show something happen, and he'll just describe what's happening in there and leave it to me as to how it plays out,
right?
And whereas I'm thinking in terms of the script and thinking panel one says, oh, these three things need to happen or we need to see an action. Sometimes it's just impossible to show an action and have someone talking over the top of it and have somebody in the background reacting to it.
Right, yeah.
Because it's a series of actions.
Yeah.
And the way those panels work, and they do work in Alien there as well, is like the tail going behind Brett and pulling him towards something off camera. That's four panels of the exact same viewpoint, and we see the action happen. Now, I realise comics wasn't made to do that, but it's something that comics has picked up from cinema.
Yeah, and it slows it down. It makes it more frightening. You can hold on that moment, can't you? Yeah, it's really well done. Yeah.
Now, that's one thing I've nicked.
Yeah, I'm a great lover using the same face a couple of times. So I wrote a script today, and it was close up on such and such's face. He doesn't understand what's going on. Same close up on his face, and he says something. And I think those little moments like that work. I think that little moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's a great bit in Invincible when he's been away for a couple of years, and he comes back from an alien planet, and he's catching up on his comics, and he goes to a con, and he's talking to the artist of one of the ones he collects, like Science Dog or something. And he says, you know, I hate that when you get an artist who just copies the same panel like three or four times just for dramatic pause, and it cuts to the guy who's the artist of the comic, and it's four panels of his face just looking at him.
That's clever. Yeah.
Because it's just, obviously, it's just copy and paste these days. You know, back then you'd have to redraw it again.
Yeah,
but and the just going on to that other one, the lettering is something that I thought I had this phenomenal idea when I was working on the first issue of Vortex. We had this situation where this rescue team go to this mining asteroid, and basically they're all wearing suits. So it's not unlike the alien scene where they're going up to see the ship. You can't see who anyone is unless you've got like really big helmet where it's all glass and it's like a big bubble and stuff. So I had this great idea of putting people's names within their speech bubbles as if it was a comm link. And not realizing, and I'm just looking at it again this weekend in Alien, that I've just lifted it from that because all the comm speak is in blue.
Yeah.
So,
and when you think about it, WhatsApp, if you're in a WhatsApp group, all the different names are in different colours and all that sort of thing, isn't it?
It's just a device that I think people are kind of used to now. I seem to remember Jamie McKelvey and who's the guy he always works
Kieran
with,
Gillen,
Kieran Gillen, using Instagram in a comic for the first time.
Christ, did they?
And,
oh, God.
And I'm thinking, like, oh, all right, mate, flipping heck, Jesus Christ. And then I'm like, I'm doing it now with, like, putting people's names on the com link things, you know. But anyway, they were the things that I think.
I think if someone ever did a comic based purely on Twitter, I might give up the hobby. I won't.
Yeah.
That's a lie.
I might take my hands off first. Yeah.
Okay. So just a couple of final questions, Dave, before we move on to your lovely work. Is have you got any other Aliens books? Do you continue to read Aliens comics, do you?
I did for quite a while, actually. I did that normal sabbatical that everyone does, where you go and discover music and boobs, you know, at a certain
other,
age.
Other secondary sexual characteristics are available.
So at a particular age, you sort of went off and, you know, didn't buy comics that much anymore, you know. And then I distinctly remember it was 89. I was 16, I think, just finished school, and I bump into a guy who I just finished school with, and he says, "We've got a comic shop in Wigan."
Oh, wow,
now.
Okay.
I'm
nice.
Just going to it. Do you want to have a look? And that was our first comic shop. It was basically a skateboard BMX shop, actually,
right.
I think, with a comic section at the back.
Nice.
And that I went in and I said, "Well, what have they got, like Transformers?" And he says, "No, it's moved on, mate, you know." And there's Dark Horse. They were just launching everything that they were doing. So it was the first. Is it Mark Verheiden?
Yeah, I think I know the Alien series before the Alien Predator one.
Yes.
Yeah.
He did the first spin off Alien Rise comic, which led straight on from the second movie. And I dived in straight onto that one and just followed it followed that for quite a few years, and it got a bit.
There was
nonsense-y.
Some highs and lows, wasn't there? There was you got a feel there's... for Dark Horse, because they had Star Wars for all those years, and they had Aliens and Predator for all those years, and now they're all lost.
Dark Horse did so much to get people like me at that age back into getting into comics.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
true.
they were the first guys who were. They said, let's just go full-blown cinematic and just have shitloads of titles that were all linked to the... You had the Aliens, you had Predator,
The first Aliens Predator was really good.
It was phenomenal, yeah. It was really good. I still hold that up as one of the nicest sort of drawn ones actually.
Yeah.
And there was a hell of a lot of silence in that, too. It was almost like a Western.
It was, wasn't it? That's very true, yeah. A couple of other favourites of mine, they're not maybe not be favourites of everyone else, but James Stokoe did Dead Orbit a couple of years ago, maybe 5 years ago.
Yes, that was nice, yeah.
That's
that
a
was
beautiful
lovely,
book.
Yeah.
And that was a beautiful weird one, slightly weird one, but I just really like it. It's just for its sort of Chazza shop kind of qualities. But there was Karim Bechko did Vampirella Aliens, which sounds
right,
proper
yeah.
wank. Do you know what I mean? To be fair, but it's quite clever when you think the vampire gets impregnated with an alien baby. It's got all kinds of things going on there, and it's quite fun. And they did it well. Do you know what I mean? I'm like you. Yeah. I did hit out a bit of Aliens. I have to say, seeing that image of a predator holding Iron Man's helmet, I'm like, really? Oh God.
Yeah, but then again, that might just be because we're old. You know, the 10-year-old version of me might go, really?
Yeah.
You know, they might get all excited about that because. Got to remember that people are just starting in comics. People have just discovered their first version of Transformers or whatever it is that we start with.
You like to think
in
so.
Terms of the aliens, in terms of the aliens ones, the ones that stood out for me. One was the second run of Alien stuff that came out after that very first follow up from the second
wasn't
movie.
Wasn't the Invasion Earth stuff? Possibly, was it the?
I think it eventually became called Invasion
Earth.
Right,
okay, yeah.
But at the time, it didn't have a name. It was basically just the next Aliens run, and it was 4 issues, and it was all painted, and I think it was by a guy called Denis Beauvais.
Right, okay. I do remember it. I remember seeing it,
And it just, oh, Christ almighty, I hadn't seen, that was like my version of seeing Alex Ross for the first time, but somebody's painted a comic, jeez.
They do sort of slightly smaller scale size digest, don't they? Like they did with the Star Wars books, you could get.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that would be that's a great one to grab as a trade if you do see it. And Aliens sort of because it was such a flagship for Dark Horse, they'd bring other people in and out of it. There was a one-off called Salvation, I think, with Mike Mignola. Doing the artwork, that was really nice.
Nice,
And another standout one for me was there was two comics under the name that I can never remember whether it's the name of the character in it. It was called Mondo Pest.
Right, okay.
And it's cartoon like, which is an odd thing to say about a comic, but it felt a bit sort of not Hanna-Barbera. Space Ghost esque.
Oh, okay.
I think.
The
artwork on it was just fun, but they had this main character in it called Herc Mondo, and it was just him getting into scrapes with aliens, and it was kind of comedic in a way. But man, they could do action really well, and just the way they rendered the aliens. I'm starting to remember a thousand things now, and I realise we're 15 minutes over time.
The other thing, we're going to talk about what we'd like to see as well. Is I just suddenly occurred to me is I would love to have seen an Absalon Dark versus aliens. Absalon Dark's Who character who got a chainsaw sword, who's nuts, and it was drawn by Steve Dillon. Imagine that. That'd have been fucking amazing.
I'd like to see aliens in Wigan.
Well, I've been there. I've always had... It's High Street, the High Street.
See, I've always had this theory. being a commuter, right, I always thought I was a commuter for 10 years in and out of Manchester, and I always had this idea that if somebody just dropped a lion in the centre of Manchester, like on a random morning every so often, and an alarm went off to let you know, then... Sooner or later, it would be survival of the fittest, and only the strong would be in the middle of town. It wouldn't be as busy, you know. All the idiots would go and get jobs elsewhere. And I thought Wigan needs that for a different reason. You just need to cull the fools, really. So just drop an alien into, because we get a hint at aliens set in a modern time in some of the worst films, which is like
we do, don't we? Yeah, Predator, I know, it's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah, I think. We had this. This was part of a conversation we had the other day. Me and the other guys who work on the comic were I'm a strong believer in like a kid's got the right idea when it comes to like taking a toy and putting it in a different environment and it's suddenly becoming like a new toy. So you've got a car and it's great to play with that car, but what if you took it to the beach? Case, you know? And I think aliens is such a simple concept. It's a scary monster, but it's a good scary
monster. You can drop it in, I don't know, you can drop Blade Runner. You know, couldn't you? And it would.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That,
yeah. And who cares about, like you and Dave said the other day, who cares about continuity and canon if it's just a good story and whether it's fun or not? So, doing aliens set in a time like now, you walk into work, you go around the corner in Manchester, and there's an alien. Jesus Christ, what do you do? There's fun to be had in that, in seeing somebody deal with it who's busy on the phone, you know.
Playing Candy Crush or something.
Whatever they play, these kids. But I like that the alien is that, and as much as I haven't bought a lot of comics for a while in terms of the alien, because I started to see a lot of repeated stories, you know, we saw it in the films. The films exploited it a long time, but there was a great one where I think the artist was Killian Plunkett, who really stuck with me. He could really draw the hell out of the alien. I think it was called Labyrinth or something like that, and it was about a guy who's keeping aliens in a lab somewhere, and he's testing them all and stuff like that, but he could draw the crap out of the alien. But that was just a perfect example of that story's been done a million times, you know. And the way to make it new is just pick it up, put it somewhere else. It's like, why is the thing so good? Because part of the characterization of the movie is it's set in the snow. It's an alien horror film in the snow. We've seen an alien horror film a million times, but this one's set in the snow, so it's suddenly more interesting.
That's true, man.
Big believer.
I've got one for you.
Big believer the environment.
We set one in, I don't know if you're ever aware of an area of London called London Fields.
I've been there for one of them flat barbecues.
You have to wear flip-flops around your head like they do in Nathan Barley, and it's that sort of type place. Talk about when you were in a band, you know, at university.
Curly moustache. Sort
of. And what you have is you have a couple of hipsters on their iPhones playing Pokemon. You know, I think I've caught one, and then you just get totally analysed by an alien. That would be my little pitch to you.
I would pay for a 4-issue run to see that. Hipsters versus aliens. It was everyone versus aliens for a long time.
A lot of zombies as well, like Cockney. There was a Cockney Batman versus zombies Predator suffered from that, didn't it? Right, we're going to pause now for our sponsor, if you don't mind, Dave. Our new, very important sponsor. Awesome. So now a word from our sponsor. Remember when "Does my bum look big in this?" or "Bish bash loads of money" were cheap comedy catchphrases? Remember when we laughed at people who fixated on themselves and they became hilarious figures of fun? No, you don't recall those days. Then why not join Twitter? You can talk about yourself all day long without anyone daring to say a word against you, obliviously happy in your own self-made idiotic fantasy world. Legal warning: may cause a loss of sexual appetite, anger management issues, and may cause you to take so many photographs of yourself that you might actually cease to exist in the real world. Thank you. That's our little Twitter advert. Thank you, Twitter, for that.
Yeah. Elite's Twitter.
They're very behind. Very that behind thing. Us on this podcast.
I hope you don't mind, mate, but I've been contacted by an organisation.
We do anything for money, my friend. If I would like to.
Yeah. Yeah. They've basically said, would I like to mention them
please
as a sponsor,
if
that's all right. Yep. Is that okay? Okay. Do you ever feel like your right to express yourself is being suppressed in some way? Do you live in a nice-smelling, silent home? Would you like to learn how to create your own personal force field to help with the current climate of social distancing? Then why not try farting? Learn to control your most musical of muscles to create a second voice for your body that will constantly surprise you with the words it creates. Words such as hish, papadaps, and the ever-surprising poip. Send a self-addressed Tupperware set to Farting Limited, Bronx Cheer Drive, Tooting, FRT1BUMBUM, and receive your free onion gravy starter pack today. Farting, let your inner self out.
Yes, I'm going to write to Fart Bum Bum and get that starter pack, I think. That sounds exceptional.
It's in Tooting. Bronx Cheer Drive in Tooting.
The farting. As a 14-year-old, a prostitute once came on to me in Tooting. That's another story. But the,
Did they?
Interesting. Yeah, thanks for that. And please send all your money in for that. You won't get anything, but please send us money.
Yeah, no
never
problem.
Never mind anything.
Send it to TS.
Never mind anything. The podcast agrees totally with that message. There you go. Cool.
Endorse.
Yeah, I endorse that message. That's all the politicians in America say, isn't it? I endorse this message of farting and analysing. Yeah. Right.
Farting.
Right, okay. Good. So a couple of things for you, man. So it's been a while since we caught up on the Awesome Pod. So you have done, as you, I think, I can't remember where we talked about this off mic, but you talked about being on the, you're on a panel for San Diego on the 24th of July, is that right?
Yes, as we know, nobody's meeting anyone anywhere these days. So San Diego is doing a virtual version, and it's free, and everyone can go and see any of the panels. I'm guessing there's going to be the same as if you were there, really, which is like a choice of 300 things going on at once. In one room, there's the guy who's going to be playing Superman next, and in another room, there's somebody telling you how to draw an apple. And you've got to decide.
Which one are you going to go to?
Whether you're going to queue for.
So this is the choice you make at these conventions, so, having done a couple. You either go and queue up for the really fun one, or there's no queue and you go to a boring one. That's how. Sometimes I just feel like sitting down, exactly, so I do sit in the back of the how to draw an apple, or, you know, intersectional brony relationships, you know, something like that. I'll sit at the back, you know.
And every so often just go, ah!
Yeah, and laugh, chuckle to myself.
That's how you do it. So we basically, it is pre-recorded, so we've already
done
the call. They're basically, they put out a timetable for it the other day, and I believe ours is on Friday the 24th at 11 p.m. UK time, and I think it's 3 p.m. Pacific time, I think. But basically, it's just going to be an hour of myself and the other guys who work on the comic. I work on Vortex, which includes Mike Sizemore, who's the writer, our Pete Kennedy, my brother, who colours it.
I was going to ask if that was your brother.
Yeah. Yeah, well, basically, I did the first issue of Vortex myself when we first got the job. I did everything. I did the lettering, the colour, the art, everything.
So for those that don't know, Vortex is a comic that's come out of John Carpenter's Tales of Science Fiction. And yes, it is that John Carpenter.
Yeah.
As we talked about before, it's the John Carpenter who created The Thing and They Live and Big Trouble in Little China, all the best movies.
His wife Sandy is like the sort of like the engine behind all of this. She's like really enthusiastic about comics. Has always loved comics. Has always gone to San Diego and New York and all the big cons and stuff like that. And a few years back, they decided they wanted to get into the comic realm. The notion of like people working in TV and stuff. It started to. And movies, it became far more linked to comics in recent times than it has been. So knowing that somebody's got a story that's already out there was a big draw if John and Sandy felt like they were going to go back to movies and TV and so on. And of course, it's John Carpenter. He's full of stories. He's got millions of them. And he developed this particular idea. Him and Sandy developed it together. And they had it as a pitch, I believe. And eventually they said to Mike, because he'd been working with them on something else, do you fancy developing it yourself? Taking this basic idea of, they said, this is when you do a pitch, a very basic pitch, you sum the whole story up pretty quickly, and that's what John and Sandy had done. So they gave it to Mike and said, do you want to write it? Do you want to be the writer who fleshes that out, and we'll do it as a comic? And I used to go to school with Mike, and Mike sort of like called on me to give it a bash, and we sort of put out this first one, and it seemed to go down really well.
Yeah,
we were really pleased with it. Sandy's pleased with it, John's pleased with it.
Sandy was at New York last year, actually. I saw her sitting there doing some autographs and stuff. They had their own table there. It wasn't far from our table, actually. So I sort of got to buy. Always busy, though.
Yeah, she's loved it. She's fantastic. Never worked for anyone nicer in my life. They basically just let us get on with what we think is going to work. They trust what we're doing. You know, mainly, you know, it's down to Mike and his relationship with them and stuff like that. But he's proved time and time again he knows, you know, how Carpenter thinks on, you know, projects and stuff. So it's nice to be for them to turn around and say, actually, we trust you to get on with it, because this is the guy who made the films I grew up on and scared the Christ out of me. So it's nice to be able to say, well, I think I know what he was aiming at, so let's give it a bash and let's see if we can make a Carpenter-esque comic, you know.
And it comes across that way. And there's definitely that feeling of the Carpenter universe, if you see what I mean, as part of it. But you've done quite a few issues now, so how far have you got into it?
Well, basically, we did one eight-issue run, which is collected into a book, which you can get on Amazon.
Yeah, it's on
Comic Con
today. Yeah.
Yes, you can actually get it. You can get a copy pretty cheap, really, from Storm King themselves, where John and Sandy signed.
Oh, really?
For,
okay.
Which I did myself, because I don't go to America a lot. So I just thought, right, this is the book I helped make, and I really want that. But it was cheap, pretty cheap, so get on it. So that first book, Vortex, came out. It was self-contained, beginning, middle, and end. And they enjoyed it so much, they came back and said, do you want to continue the story? So the second story, which is the first issue, has just come out this month, has started. I'm still working my way through the artwork, but it's all on schedule. It's all on time, if you're listening, Sean.
You're not really drawing it with a banana.
All is well.
Although I did laugh at that big sleep part of it.
Yeah, you know, help the industry, mate. Help the industry with fruit.
I do love the lampooning of that. So there's this, for those who didn't see it on Dave's Facebook or Twitter, I can't remember what it was now, there was this ultra serious, if you're involved in the arts, we need to support the arts, we need to keep them going. Put a picture of yourself working involved in the, you've got all these like terribly pretentious actors showing themselves acting or playing fucking mandolins or something, you know, and Dave's at his screen concentrating drawing, but you notice in his hand he's holding a banana.
It was delicious too. So yeah, very very briefly, obviously I haven't been brief so far, but why change? Vortex, we're on Vortex 2 now, and it's an 8-issue run.
Nice.
Again, issue 1 came out last month, and we're wazzing our way through it now. It probably will be collected into a book, like the first one, and it's great to work on.
That's a nice long run of a title as well, isn't it? It's a nice place to be as an artist and as a freelancer, I suppose.
Absolutely. I mean, I've worked with people in the past who have literally changed my artwork and put it out. and I think, like, well, that's got my name on it. You know, there's a value to that. If somebody goes back looking for my work, they'll see that somebody thought somebody needed bigger boobs for no reason whatsoever. And so that's what these guys used to do with my stuff. I think, oh, Christ almighty. But then again, I guess artists have to deal with that. You know, it's just been really, really lucky with John and Sandy in that they just trust us. They just let us get on with it. I've literally had nobody ask me to change anything I've done while working for them.
Yeah.
I just get emails back saying,
it looks great,
carry
man.
On.
I've read it and it looks amazing. Yeah, it's great. Best stuff you've done easily, I think, as well. It's my favourite stuff I've seen of yours. Yeah, really good, man.
Now it's my turn not to take a compliment. Oh, stop it, Tony, stop it.
Good old man.
Yeah, and so we are going to be. Well, I was going to say we are going to be chatting about it on the San Diego panel.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to list that. It's in my diary. It's on the Tribute Press calendar, as me and Adam used to like to refer to it, which is just a calendar on my desk.
Right.
But
I do give a little shout out to this podcast.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, no, you said that's very kind of you. Thank you.
This one and the ACP are always at the top of the list. When the refresh comes around,
you're
on
always
Monday,
the one who's pressing that button on the Facebook group. Yeah, it's always good.
Yeah. Bleep. Yeah, some days, some weeks it goes bleep, some weeks it goes boff. But that button is always pressed.
Thanks for the support, man. I know you've been with us for years. You've listened to us for years as well, which is very kind of you.
Well, since the beginning, mate, since we started, 5 bloody years, long years. Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll see you at the 300. It's great. Thinking about having like a little get together or something, like we did at the 200. Oh, but yeah, hopefully we'll see you there, man. It's a while since I've seen you in person. I think the last time is I jumped on your back at Thought Bubble, didn't I? And you said I was dry bumming yours.
That is right. Yes. Yeah, it's a shame we're not getting that this year. After being to cons in different capacities over the years, Thought Bubble just is totally outstanding amongst them.
Compare it to
just
like flipping him
comics
or something.
Chatting about comics.
Yeah, I'm really sad. I don't think New York haven't declared, but there's no way that's happening. And there's no way we'd get to it anyway if it did. That's a shame.
Even if they put it on, the people who go would have to think about whether they need to go or not.
Yeah.
And so it's just not a good situation for anyone worldwide. But
we're struggling,
we'll get
back
to it,
man. I'm beating my way through my reading pile, you know.
Yeah, that's good.
I like to beat myself off in the comic room quite a lot, to be fair, but yeah. Good. Where can people find your stuff, David?
That's a weird one. Well, basically, you can find the Vortex stuff at Storm King Comics. So if you search for, I could give you addresses, but I always struggled with the phrase "a can of lilt." I feel a bit funny saying that, and www feels a bit similar. I can feel my mouth going like I'm having a stroke when I do it, so I don't like giving out full addresses, but just search for Storm King Comics and you will just search for Storm King Comics and you'll find us, you'll find our stuff. You can get it on Comixology as well. And if you're looking for me, I live at 21. You can find me, just search for the word Cherry Sheriff on Twitter. And
worth following all over the place. If not just for the kitchen utility techno, also for the putting the bins out song, another favourite of mine, of yours.
Putting the bins
as well
out,
as some marvellous artwork, man. Yeah, it's always great to watch your stuff.
Oh, cheers, dude.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant, man. I'm real pleased. And we were so excited that you're working with Carpenter. We got like super excited. You know, it's like, oh god.
You
must be over the moon. Yeah.
I'm shouting it at my wife. My wife's from Japan, and she's not been brought up on the same films and cultural things I have. And I'm saying, "We're working with John Carpenter." She's saying, "That's nice. Who is John?
Nice. He sounds like a nice man."
Who is John?
Mine's the same as my missus. She, you know, she actively despises anything to do with comics. You know, I get very excited. Yeah, there you go. You can find my stuff over at neveronanything.bigcartel.com or tributepress.bigcartel.com if you're from it.
And you absolutely should. You absolutely should, because I've just got the comics this week. And as I told Tony earlier, he seems to have developed a character that is one of the most frightening characters I've ever read.
A xenomorph crossover one day.
He genuinely scares me.
You never know.
Osman versus aliens.
No connection. I'm going to say goodbye to you now, Dave, and we're going to continue talking in a second, which won't be recorded. Nobody will get to hear. So cheers, man. See you later. Take care.
Thanks very much. Cheers.